I'm David Marr, host of Late Night Live on ABC Radio National. For nearly 40 years, the show has been asking the best writers, thinkers, and provocateurs big questions about our changing world.
It's a power grab in advance.
But as institutions collapse, narcissists thrive.
And people were willing to take risks.
4 brand new episodes each week on the ABC Listen app.
This is Rear Vision on Radio National. I'm Ros Bluett. Today, the 6 Gulf countries of the Middle East.
The Gulf countries are very, very new states.
They're like cars that went from 0 to 100 kilometers an hour in no time at all. Built from oil.
All the states got richer.
They were able to take all this money and realize their dreams.
And the rulers have made some brilliant strategic economic choices.
Now the economic powerhouses of the Middle East, the Gulf states of Qatar, Kuwait, Bahrain, the UAE, Oman, and Saudi Arabia are now significant players on the world stage.
The Gulf Cooperation Council's defence ministers are meeting to discuss activating their joint defence mechanism.
We have strong relationships with our Gulf allies. We work very closely with them on a number of things.
These countries are not tools in the hands of superpowers. They pursue their own goals, and survival is at the core of this whole endeavour.
From small sheikdoms bordering the western edge of the Persian Gulf, and across the water from Iran, these 6 countries of the Arabian Peninsula have now considerable agency in the Middle East. How have they got here, and how are they using their power to shape the region today? What's so fascinating is the speed at which they've developed. Professor Gregory Gause is visiting scholar at the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C., and says at the start of the 20th century, this land looked very different.
The Arabian Peninsula as a whole was basically a backwater in global politics for centuries. The Arabian Peninsula was always important for the Muslim world because in what's now Saudi Arabia, you have the holy cities of Mecca and Medina. But basically, Arabia was not particularly important economically and not particularly important strategically. The configuration of the states of the Gulf region itself comes from British colonialism, which enters the area largely because it was a way station on the way to India. And thus, India being the most important British colony in Asia, the routes to India were an essential element of British imperial strategy. So the British government began to sign treaties with various tribal sheikhs along the Arab side of the Persian Gulf. And it was from those treaties in the 19th century that we get British protection of what became the Sultanate of Oman, 7 of which came to form the United Arab Emirates. Qatar, Bahrain, and Kuwait also were under these British protection elements. Now, Saudi Arabia is a different story, much bigger. It had been ruled by competing families. One of these families was the Al Saud family. And in 1901, his son, a guy named Abdulaziz, retakes Riyadh. And Abdulaziz, who the West knows as Ibn Saud, then basically builds modern Saudi Arabia through conquest in alliance with Britain. Although the British never had a protectorate relationship with the Al Saud family, the way they did with the other families along the coast, the smaller states. British money, British guns helped the Al Saud fight their rivals who were allies of the Ottomans.
By the end of World War I, Ottoman control over Saudi Arabia was no longer a threat to the region. Britain became protectorate of the smaller Gulf states, working with their royal families to ensure smooth sailing. David Mednikoff is Professor of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Massachusetts.
These were called protectorate agreements, where essentially the United Kingdom would govern all of their external affairs. And the British didn't do a whole lot. The British in general were known in the Middle East for not helping governance and not helping develop the societies. You know, like, for example, Doha, Qatar was a pearl trading area, but not much else going on. If you look at pictures of Abu Dhabi in the 1950s, there's nothing. It's like these small towns. Saudi Arabia, by far the biggest country geographically and population-wise among those Gulf countries.
Saudi Arabia, never formally colonized, never formally under protection of Great Britain. The smaller states, Kuwait, Bahrain, Qatar, the seven emirates that form the United Arab Emirates, and Oman, all under British protection. Britain was interested in this part of the world because of the routes to India. But once oil gets discovered in this area and oil becomes a strategic commodity, British Navy switches over to run on oil in the early 1900s, Britain had another interest in the Gulf. It wasn't simply a road to India. It was also the source of this new fuel that was not only commercially important, but strategically important for the British Navy. So the Brits stayed in the Gulf even after they gave up India, right? Even after India, Pakistan become independent. So 1947, when India becomes independent, Britain stays in the Gulf, largely because of oil, but also because the rulers on the Arab side of the Gulf really didn't have any problem with Britain. Britain let them rule their own societies, provided them with subsidies, officered their armies, organized their police, and protected them.
Britain worked closely with these royal families, and these royal families never thought of Britain as a colonial power.
Ellen Manaya is adjunct professor of political science at Zurich University.
It was mutual interest, I'll put it this way. They always maintained a very strong relationship with Britain until Britain decided to leave the region. And it announced that in 1968. Britain was ailing. It has a lot of internal economic problems. It has a lot of issues that made it clear, now I need to withdraw. And we have to do that in an orderly manner in order not to end up with a mess like the one in south of Yemen that does not allow for a power vacuum that can be filled by the Soviet Union. We're talking here within the context of the Cold War.
The British withdrawal from the Gulf is 1971. Kuwait becomes independent in 61. And then the rest of the states become independent in 71. They're extremely important now on the world scene because they're major producers of oil. Kuwait, about 2 million barrels a day. The United Arab Emirates now about 2.5-3 million barrels a day. Qatar, a major producer of natural gas, has one of the largest reserves of natural gas in the world, even though it's a tiny little country. And so when Britain leaves, the United States is interested in maintaining a position here. American oil companies had developed the oil resources of Saudi Arabia. And so America had a strong relationship with Saudi Arabia and had hoped that the British would sustain a position in the Gulf with the smaller Gulf states. When the Brits didn't, the United States over time became more the protector of those states.
Britain left the region, the United States entered in. And in cooperation with these countries, and here it's very important to understand its interdependence. It's not dependence, interdependence from the perspective of these countries. And they learned over time how to leverage their oil and resources. The United States and the industrial world was in strong need of the oil resources of the Gulf countries. And in return for the oil, these Gulf countries got the protection from the United States.
The United States was happy to work with compliant governments. And as long as the oil flowed, they didn't pass judgment on who they were.
The governments that stayed in control were the governments that already control. I mean, every one of these societies, rulers, you know, basically monarchical rulers, whatever they call themselves, are from a tribe and a dynasty that goes back centuries. The Al Thanis in Qatar go back couple hundred years. It's true for each and every one of them. Continuity of the royal families.
All of them are authoritarian with the exception of Kuwait. Kuwait has always had a functioning parliament together with the institution of the emir, the ruler. And yes, the United States has always supported these regimes, not only in the Gulf, but outside of the Gulf, regardless of the type of authoritarian regime existing or the human rights violation taking place. Economics, that's the core of it. Food and up through the ground come a bubbling crude.
Oil, that is, black gold, Texas tea. Oil and natural gas become such an important global resource. The way you see things develop is just extraordinary. There are other societies like this. Singapore is one that comes to mind. But it's really an unusual story of societies going from virtual backwaters to tourism economic destinations that are on the top of the hierarchy in terms of development.
The Gulf countries started to learn how to leverage their resources to their own benefit, and to an extent that sometimes you see that they are the one who are manipulating the superpowers. And 1973, that's a very important date, because there you had the war between Egypt, Syria, and Israel, and Saudi Arabia entered in that war by using oil as leverage in that conflict. And the European countries, the United States, all of them felt the burden of that action. And it led to a spike in the oil prices, but it also highlighted the importance of that strategy. And during that period, 70s onward, you have the Nixon doctrine is stating that we will help countries that are our allies. You had the twin pillars, Saudi Arabia and Iran, as the two countries that the United States depended on in its Cold War with the Soviet Union. Saudi Arabia and Iran were certainly not hostile. Once you have the revolution, the Islamic Revolution in 1979, things changed drastically.
The men of Iran have overthrown a Western-style ruler. The Shah, who ruled the oil-rich country from the peacock throne, has been hounded out by his own people, taking only the treasures he could carry on his plane to supplement his holdings abroad. And with the monarch gone, the West will now have to deal with men responsible to the crowd, in one of our main oil suppliers and buyers of Western military equipment.
Before the Iranian Revolution of 1979, the United States relied on its strong ally, the Shah of Iran, to provide security in that region. But when the Shah was overthrown and a government very hostile to the United States took over, the United States became more and more militarily committed to the Gulf region. So these states, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Bahrain, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, and Oman, shared a lot in common. They're all monarchies. There was a sense of monarchical solidarity among those six states. But there were also tensions among them. They had border disputes among them. The smaller ones worried about Saudi Arabia. Would Saudi Arabia become so dominant as for the smaller ones to kind of lose their independence?
The Gulf states' growing importance for the world's energy supplies gave them some assurance they'd be protected. But they realised they had to begin to work together, especially when their interests were threatened by the Iran-Iraq War in 1980.
They created in 1981 the Gulf Cooperation Council, and it was because of the Iranian-Iraqi War. But they recognised that what brings them together is not only oil, it's their type of system. These are tribal monarchies, if you may put it this way. And their common origin, if you exclude Sultanate of Oman, the royal families, they come from the heart of Saudi Arabia. And these tribal allegiances are important. It can be a source of friction, like between Qatar and Saudi Arabia, but at the same time, that brings them together.
I think the formation of the Gulf Cooperation Council in 1981 was an immediate reaction to the Iranian Revolution and the Iran-Iraq War, which had begun in September of 1980. the Gulf states, including Saudi Arabia, were afraid of Iran's political influence and its desire to spread the revolution throughout the Gulf region and the whole Middle East. And they were also worried about Iraq, which was militarily powerful, led by a very ambitious and ruthless leader in Saddam Hussein, who represented an Arab nationalist leftist party, which was also not something that monarchies liked. And so I think it was both the Iranian revolutionary threat and the Iraqi military threat that brought these countries together and led the smaller states to put aside their worries about being dominated by Saudi Arabia to say, we've got to hang together if we're not going to hang separately.
You're listening to Rear Vision on Radio National. I'm Ros Bluett. And today we're looking at the very modern history of the six Gulf countries of the Arabian Peninsula. In 1990, when Iraq invaded Kuwait, the smaller Gulf states saw how they could leverage greater US protection.
These states were positioned in the oil patch of the Persian Gulf. The smaller ones were able to do the kinds of deals with the United States that provided them the kind of protection that Britain had offered previously. And in fact, the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait in 1990 led to a huge military mobilization by the United States. That led to the establishment of a number of permanent U.S. military bases in these smaller states. A large American military base in Kuwait. There's an American fleet dedicated to the Persian Gulf and Arabian Sea, Indian Ocean area called the Fifth Fleet. It is headquartered in Bahrain. Qatar is home to the largest American air base in the Middle East, Al Udeid Air Base. And the United States has access to military facilities in both the United Arab Emirates and Oman. And at times of crisis, the Saudis have also provided the United States with access to military facilities. So the United States has become the protector of those states.
But in 2011, this equilibrium was upset by rising democracy movements across the Middle East, culminating in the Arab Spring.
Saudi forces moved into Bahrain to crush the pro-democracy movement. Soon after, Bahrain's king declared a three-month state of emergency.
United Nations Chief Ban Ki-moon has given a bleak assessment of the situation in Syria.
21 opposition figures in Bahrain are today beginning sentences of between 5 years and life for their part in the Arab Spring protests earlier this year.
The 2011 Arab uprisings, which overthrew a lot of governments, scared the hell out of every government in the region because, you know, these are not democratically elected governments. The Gulf monarchies are popular with their populations. I don't want to suggest that they rule with a very strong iron fist in the Arab, but they sure as heck are not democracies, and they don't pretend to be. You know, the main thing was, how do we keep stability? How do we stop from there being threats? Well, you know, one way is to really project your power in various ways, which they've done. And another is to sort of watch out for where the instability is coming from. And their neighbor across that body of water, Iran, that's where the instability has largely been coming from in their minds. I mean, it isn't just in their minds. Iran has been seen as an ideological threat and a military threat. That's had a lot to do with their policy. Well, you know, there's another country in the Middle East and North Africa that sees Iran as a huge threat, and that country is Israel. So there have been a lot of incentives as the Gulf states have gotten more powerful and as they feared that Iran is a source of instability, there have been a lot of incentives for the Gulf states to have some kind of relationships with Israel. I do want to qualify this by saying that each one of these Gulf countries has a different relationship with Iran. But Saudi Arabia and Iran have been at loggerheads. And so working pragmatically with Israel, a very powerful state that has long seen Iran as the major threat, has gradually over time made a lot of sense. If these Gulf countries are looking for a stable region with an economy where there's a lot of trade, help with their security, a country that's producing a lot of sophisticated software, spyware, and things, there are reasons for them to work with Israel.
Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, you have leadership that has a vision that wants to push them in the 21st century. And that means we have to deal with the issue of artificial intelligence, renewable energy. And that cannot be done without Israel.
So there have been under the table dealings with Israel for some time. These became more public under the first Trump administration, where the United States gave a big push for governments in the Arab world to formally, diplomatically recognize Israel. Under American pressure and with American inducements, Bahrain and the UAE joined what the Trump administration called the Abraham Accords, recognized Israel in 2020. The other states held back. Qatar had a strong relationship with Turkey and with the Muslim Brotherhood, which kept them at arm's length from Israel. Oman had contacts with Israel, but wasn't ready to diplomatically recognize. And Kuwait, because it had a parliament, couldn't do it. The Saudis were the big prize here. But the Saudis wanted a bigger price for recognition of Israel from the United States than the United States was ready to give at that time. The Saudis wanted a formal security treaty with the United States, which they've never had. They wanted American help to develop their nuclear infrastructure. The Biden administration was negotiating with Saudi Arabia to provide the security treaty and the nuclear help in exchange for a Saudi recognition of Israel when Hamas attacked Israel in October of 2023, on October 7th. And that basically ended the prospect of the Saudis, in effect, joining the Abraham Accords.
Israel's response to the October 23 attacks by Hamas and its relentless bombardment of Gaza galvanized the Palestinian issue among the populations of the Gulf states.
Gulf Arab citizens don't want to see Palestinians slaughtered. We are all Arabs, however rhetorical it might be. This comes in. Most Arabs are quite concerned about the terrible situation that Palestinians have lived in the West Bank and Gaza Strip and, you know, want there to be progress. But leaders in these wealthier states can find working with Israel useful. We haven't seen the UAE cancel the Abraham Accords, but they certainly are not comfortable working with this type of a militaristic Israel.
The United Arab Emirates, when there was discussion about the West Bank being taken over by Israel, there you saw a red line that was drawn by the United Arab Emirates. That's not peace that we're talking about here. The Arab opinion surveys has shown that you cannot ignore your own population.
So enormous amounts of sympathy for the Palestinians in the public opinion of these states. And when the Saudis get back to considering the possibility of recognition of Israel, they've been very clear since October 7th that the Israelis are going to have to commit to a timeline to Palestinian statehood, which of course the current Israeli government is not willing to do. The driver of Gulf state interest in relations with Israel was their fear of Iran. And it's the classic case of the enemy of my enemy is my friend. The Israelis saw Iran as a big threat. The Gulf states saw Iran as a big threat. Let's see what we can do together. And of course, the United States encourages this cooperation. The results of the Gaza war made Iran weaker and thus perceived as less threatening in the Gulf and made Israel a more difficult partner because of its treatment of the Palestinians. And thus, what was before October 7th, 2023, a lot of momentum toward other Gulf states joining the Abraham Accords. I think that that momentum has slowed down, if not halted for now.
So where does this leave the Gulf countries? These states want a Middle East that the world wants to do business with and are invested in returning the region to stability. Qatar, for example, prides itself on being the mediator.
Qatar developed as the Switzerland of the Middle East. They've had a better relationship with Iran than, say, Saudi Arabia. They try to be on good terms with all the countries in the region. And there's a sort of a Swiss-style ideology that they just believe that people from different political perspectives or different countries ought to be able to talk to each other. And certainly the Qataris would like to be on good terms with everybody.
Nobody's the Switzerland of the Middle East because nobody's really neutral and nobody makes really good watches. I think that a number of these Gulf states would like to play the role of mediator because they're small and they're relatively weak militarily, even though they're rich. And so they want to be useful to the great powers, particularly the United States. This mediation role that Qatar has played is unique because the Qataris for decades have had close relations with Islamist groups, including the Muslim Brotherhood. This put them at odds with Egypt, with Saudi Arabia, with the Emirates. But there's also some usefulness in these contacts that the Qataris had with the Muslim Brotherhood. Hamas in Gaza is basically the Palestinian Muslim Brotherhood. The Qataris had contacts with the Taliban. And the Trump administration, the Biden administration, they use these contacts to the extent that even the Israelis permitted Qatar to fund the Hamas government in Gaza as an alternative to Iran funding them. So the Qataris played this double game very successfully. Contacts with the Islamists, contacts with the Americans, home to the biggest American airbase in the region. So the Qataris, they walk a tightrope, but they've done it relatively successfully. Having said that, the Qataris were bombed by Iran in June and then by Israel more recently. So there are risks in the kinds of strategy Qatar is pursuing.
When Israel bombed Qatar, there are a lot of people saying, well, you know, this is going to lead to a big rupture between the Gulf states and the United States. And it is a big deal. I mean, it's a gross violation of international law, and it was a big deal. But what did Qatar say at the time? They said, well, you know, well, we're not sure we're going to be willing to do any more mediation. We have to see. But we're not saying 100% no. You know, they went to Trump. They said, look, you have to give us some guarantees. And the thing about Trump is that he doesn't have enough consistent political ideology to know when he's doing something that seems like a little politically weird. So he actually did tell Netanyahu, don't do this stuff anymore. You know, you can't bomb our allies. So here we are. You know, Qatar is right back in this mediation game. They've gotten some assurances from the United States. They want this war to end. They want to get some credit for it.
Fighting wars in the Gulf region is not good for these countries. It's not good for their economic stability. It's not good for oil production, and it's not good for their citizens because they can become targets, as we've seen. All of these countries are thinking about what a post-oil world will look like because oil is the thing that's made them rich and important. It's not like we're going to have a post-oil world next year or even next decade. But they all have economic plans to try to improve their non-oil economies. And that requires foreign investment, it requires trade, it requires tourism, and all of those things are damaged by regional conflict and regional tensions.
Professor Gregory Gores, visiting scholar at the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C. You also heard David Mednikoff, Professor of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Massachusetts, and Ellen Manea, Adjunct Professor of Political Science at Zurich University. And the final word today from Gregory Gores.
I would say there's three big uncertainties right now. There's the uncertainty of where Iran is going to go. The second uncertainty is Israel. And the third uncertainty, which is an uncertainty that everybody around the world experiences, is what's the Trump administration up to? President Trump can turn on a dime. This Gaza ceasefire that he's negotiated, if he walks away from it now, it will not happen. Those three uncertainties continue to plague the Gulf states.
You've been listening to Rear Vision on Radio National. I'm Ros Bluett. Thanks for your company.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.